We've called this sermon series 10 Ways God is Different from Us and Why That's a Good Thing. And I wonder if, of all of them that we're going to look at, I wonder if perhaps it's this one this evening, the incomprehensibility of God. I wonder if that one is the hardest to understand as a good thing. How does it help us to know that God is incomprehensible? Isn't that, after all, partly why we read our Bibles and come to church, to be able to comprehend God? Why does it help God's reputation to be known as incomprehensible? It's not a standard compliment, is it, that we ever pay to somebody? You know the old joke about ministers, don't you? 6 days a week, invisible. 1 day a week, incomprehensible. Well, let me give you the definition right up front of what we're looking at here. And then let me tell you why it's a good thing for us. And then we're going to look at what I think is probably the Bible's greatest, biggest example of someone coming face to face with the incomprehensibility of God. So here's the definition. You see, when we say that God is incomprehensible, we are not saying that he cannot be known. We're simply saying he cannot be known completely. There is mystery to God. We can know God truly, but we cannot know him fully. We can know God truthfully, but we cannot know him utterly. Who God is and what God does and how and why God has done what he has done, those are the things we will spend eternity in a new world exploring, a new world where Christ, our Lion Lamb, will be our King forever. We will come to know more and more and more of God, and every single time we feel like we've climbed Everest, right in front of us will be another Everest to climb. We will keep exploring who God is forever. And so here's why that is a good thing. The application is very, very simple of all of this. Here's why that is good. It makes us humble. It teaches us the limits of being a creature. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought of this. Here's a really important thing to realize. That the great sin in the Garden of Eden for Adam and Eve, the great sin was not turning away from God, but trying to turn themselves into God. Do you remember what the serpent said to Eve? Look, Eve, the reason God doesn't want you to touch this is because he knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like him, knowing good and evil. That's what the temptation was. It was to know what God knows, to have God's knowledge. Think about it. Wow, wouldn't that be wonderful? Imagine knowing what God knows. That is the sinful desire of human beings. Not so much to run from God, although we do that too. But underlying it, the reason we run is because we want to be God. The glorious truth of God's incomprehensibility is there to say to us, this far and no further. There are certain things only God knows. Theologians, when they come down out of those ivory towers that they live in, theologians who have thought about God's incomprehensibility, when they put it into plain language, here's a lovely phrase that they use. Theologians say, don't forget, God has a private life. God has a private life. There are things about him only he knows. And it is immensely humbling. And you know, it is often immensely difficult to accept that there are limits to our knowledge. So true, isn't it? Think about this evening, okay? The service is over. You look across and you see Johnny and Rory talking after the service and no one bats an eyelid, okay? You think, fine. That's their conversation. Don't need to know what they're talking about. But think what happens instead when you see Rory cup his mouth to Johnny's ear and just whisper something into his ear. All of a sudden you want to know, don't you? A secret has been shared. You see it on TV these days with footballers. Cameras are everywhere. They can now lip read. So every time you see a footballer speaking on TV, they cover their mouths, don't they? I saw it just yesterday. Two players on the bench. Nobody else can see what I'm saying. And the moment you see that happening, oh, how we long to know. What is it that they're saying? It is not just humbling to not know. It is often oh so difficult to not know. So we're going to look this evening at one particular example in the Bible of one person face to face with God's incomprehensibility. I've picked Job because I want this to be as helpful to us as possible. We all know, don't we, sooner or later, something will come our way that will put our trust in God under attack. We know that's true. It's what happened to Job, isn't it? Remember, he's the man in the Bible who lost everything. Job was left in utter perplexity about the mystery of God's ways. He stared at God's incomprehensibility right up close. What did he see when he did that? How did God treat him and speak to him and help him? I think Job is so important for us to look at, for this is the world we live in, isn't it? A 4-year-old girl is walking with her grandmother, and a tipper truck rolls out of control and crushes her to death. The light of two parents' lives is turned out. They're plunged into darkness. A baby swallows a lithium battery, which lodges itself in the baby's throat and through releasing electrical current causes severe internal bleeding. It incapacitates the child, leaving them with devastating life-threatening injuries. A man loses his wealth, his business, his children. His children lose their wives, and even this man loses his own health. A man who loved God and who walked with God, and who God himself said was blameless and upright. You add to the list, add your own list. In it all, we all know that some experiences in life put our trust in God under attack. And the questions begin, Job's questions begin. You did this to me, Lord? Where are you? How can you? Why? How can you be right to treat me so wrong? We looked at Job only a few years ago in church, Sunday evenings in fact, and as we were looking at it, I learned for the first time that these final glorious chapters at the end, the famous chapters, the bits everybody reads in Job, we read chapter 1 and 2, skip the rest, come to these glorious bits at the end. What I learned is that these chapters are not about God speaking an answer to Job's questions of suffering. I used to think that the book of Job was Job suffering terribly, and all along he's asking God for the reason why, and then we come to the end and God speaks to him out of the storm and helps Job understand his problem of suffering. But that's not right, is it? Here's what I learned when we looked at it before. I learned God does not answer Job's questions about the problem of evil and suffering out there in the world or in his own life. He never makes the reasons for those things clear. But God does make something clear. Here's what God makes clear. He lets Job know what answers to the problem of evil and suffering are not acceptable in his universe. God makes it very clear to Job that to accuse God of wrongdoing is a very, very serious matter. And it is always, always wrong to accuse God of wrongdoing. It's clear that that's what Job learns, isn't it? Look forward to chapter 40. Chapter 40, verse 1. The Lord said to Job, "Will the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? Let him who accuses God answer him. Job has begun to accuse God of doing wrong. But look where God brings Job to. Job answered the Lord, "I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke once, but I have no answer. Twice, but I will say no more." Job realizes, "I am unworthy," in beginning to accuse you of wrong. See, friends, I think the book of Job is here for God to say to us in life, learn with God, learn to stand down your inner prosecutor. Stand down your inner prosecutor. Stand him down. Stand her down. God is saying to Job, there are things about this world and about how and why I do what I do that you do not, cannot, will not ever know. You are not built to know. I want to just take us this evening through such a beautiful passage, through three sets of images. I think that's the way to do it. Look at the images that Job is being given here. And then I want to finish by trying to explain what I think God is saying to Job and to us through these images. What he's saying to us when our experiences of life put our trust in him under attack. See, in this chapter, what God is doing is he's introducing Job to the extremities of the world. It's all about geographical extremes. And it's geographical extremes in three different directions. Deep down beneath him, east and west, the two far-off horizons, and thirdly, the extreme of the sky, the height above him. And it's not just that canopy overhead that God is talking about, what we look up and see. It's what lies beyond it, the stars, the storehouses where all the elements come from. So three extremes here that God is speaking about, depth, width, and height. The God of infinite mystery means limitless mystery. The mystery of God goes on and on and on, right to the edges of the galaxy. And it's as if God says to Job here, let's go on a journey to those outer edges. Let's go on a tour where no one else goes. So first image here, the deep. There is a depth dimension to the universe that is mysterious. You see it, verse 4. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundations? Deep, deep down. Verse 8 again, the depth of the sea. Look at verse 16, because here what happens is God uses the sea as an image of a place for death. It's as if God is saying the seabed of the deepest, darkest ocean. It's as if you went right down there, that is the boundary line between the sea and the place of the dead. See, God is saying to Job, there is another world beyond this one. The place where the dead go when they pass from life to death. Do you know where that boundary line is, Job? Have you ever seen it? Have you ever seen the doorway to the next world? See, that phrase in verse 18, have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Probably, first of all, the image in your mind is the kind of thing that you see from an airplane window, isn't it? The vast expanses of the desert, or the vast expanses of the sea stretched out. But actually, that phrase in verse 18 refers not to the surface of the world, but to the vast expanse of the underworld. You think what you can see is big, Job. But have you any idea about the size of the parts of the earth you can't see? I saw a very small example of it just this week. I don't know if you saw that video on the BBC News website. I showed it to my children. I don't know if it was a good idea or not, but they were fascinated. In California, a helicopter flying over the sea had to say through a megaphone announcement from the helicopter to the beach to tell people to get out of the water. There were 15 great white sharks in the water, swimming near people in the water. And from the helicopter, you can see the sharks in the water and people having to leave the water. God is saying to Job, from up high, where I am, I can see right down into the deeps of the parts of the world that nobody else can see. Not long ago as well on the BBC there was the news about scientists discovering more about the Earth's core. The Earth's core is too deep to drill down to it, so they are bouncing sonar waves off the Earth's core to get new information about its substance. All of that is happening right down deep. And as I read that news about what scientists are doing, I imagine God saying to Job, "Look, Job, have you seen the latest findings? Look at your army of brilliant scientists doing the best you can. And yes, it really is quite brilliant. But can you see, Job, there is a part of the earth that you cannot even see?" Doesn't make it any less real. It's there. Do you know it, Job? Those wildlife programs that send probes down to the deepest, darkest parts of the ocean that are just too deep and too dark for any person to ever get to. See what God's saying to Job in verse 16? "Job, that's where I go for a stroll. I go for a walk. You don't do that, Job, do you?" Now another extremity. Number two, or rather a pair of extremities. Verse 19. "Here are the horizons of east and west." And it's as if God is saying there are two homes in the universe, one for light and one for darkness, and every day they go on a journey from one place to the other. Light goes from one to the other, and then back to where it belongs. Somewhere in the east there is a home for light, somewhere in the west there is a dwelling place for nighttime. Do you know how each one finds their way home and gets to where they're meant to be? We've had Daisy Cooper with us this past week, Tuesday to Friday. And Daisy's at that most wonderful stage of being beautifully, easily led. Doesn't really know us very well, but you just put out your hand, she looks at you, sizes you up, quickly decides it's okay. You just put out your hand, she puts her hand in yours and follows you wherever you go. See what God's saying to Job, verse 19? "Have you ever done that with the light, Job? Just put it in your hand and said, 'Come on, this way, follow me.'" See, just notice something here. God is not talking to Job about things he has no experience of. He's not introducing new phenomena into his world. No, every single day Job sees light and sees darkness. And yet, here's the very point. There is so much about what you see that you do not know, Job. There is so much about what you see that you cannot understand and you cannot control. Your knowledge, Job, is limited and finite. So he's taken Job down to the depth of the earth. He's taken him to the farthest widths of the earth. Where is there left to go next? Verse 22. "Up to the highest heavens." Most of these images here from verse 22 are to do with water, aren't they? One of them is to do with the stars, but most are to do with water. And again, this is a familiar thing to Job. We all live and die for water. It's all around us. It was a common part of Job's world. He knew all about it, and yet, here God is saying to him, "You know virtually nothing about it, Job. Snow and hail, which you have no control over." Well, snow and hail, that's what I keep in the sheds out the back. Have you ever seen them? Do you know how to unlock the gates and send them crashing down on the earth? Where does the lightning actually come from? Well, I know you can do your scientific experiments on the physics of it. You can look at the pressure forces which combine with light to cause it. But God is asking Job, "Tell me, can you actually pinpoint the very place it comes from? Or the place where the wind begins to blow and spread across the earth?" It's beautifully put, isn't it? Verse 34. Verse 34. "Can you raise your voice to the clouds and cover yourself with a flood of water? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you? Here we are." When Daisy arrived in our home on Tuesday morning, she met Angela at the door, went past her, walked into the dining room, And there were five of us sitting there at the dining table, almost complete strangers to her. And she looked into the room and she just said, "Hi, I'm Daisy." See verse 35? "That's what the lightning does to me," says God. "Hi, it's us. Where do you want us today?" Amazing, isn't it? It's the same verses 31 to 33. Pleiades, Orion. See, the idea here in those verses is that, poetically speaking, it's as if the stars and the constellation of the stars, it's as if they're controlled by cords on a chain, just like you pull up your blind and down, morning, evening. God is saying to Job, "I've got the whole set of stars in the sky tied up, bind up during the daytime, but at nighttime I just unleash them. Let them loose across the sky. Can you do that, Job?" God is asking him. "What do you do at nighttime, Job? Light a candle or two? I send the stars out to play." It's actually the same image here, isn't it, as leading the light dark by the hand across the sky. It's one thing to have one child in your hand following you. But you've seen, haven't you? I often feel sorry for them, those school teachers out on a day trip, and all the children are in those luminous jackets, and you have a poor teacher at the front and 600 children behind them streaming up the road. "That's me with the stars," God says. "I walk out and they all follow me. They all come out." Now just observe in all of this beautiful poetry here in the chapter about God controlling the water and the weather and the stars in the sky. The point is not just that God knows where it comes from, but also that he is wise enough to use each bit at the right time in the right way. Do you see that? Verse 25, snow and hail for times of war, but also torrents of rain, verse 25, to irrigate the parched land and satisfy a desolate wasteland. See, God is saying, not just I can lift my voice and tip over the buckets that store the water in the sky, but when I do that, I know what effect it will have on the earth. I know when and where to use the toys I have in my backyard. You see how all of God's power is connected to all of God's wisdom? Verse 36. "Who endowed the heart with wisdom or gave understanding to the mind? Who has the wisdom to count the clouds? Who can tip over the water jars of the heavens at just the right time when the dust becomes hard and the clods of earth stick together?" God is saying to Job and to us, pick your place anywhere in the world. Pick your time in any era of world history where we look at the cosmos and we say to ourselves, that particular place is out of reach. What is it at the minute? Space? Probably not quite the final frontier anymore. But still out there are planets we haven't yet reached, inhabited, populated, tested, tried. God is saying, pick that furthest point. Job, it's all here inside my hands. It's true, isn't it, that whoever controls the edges has control of the whole. Think of an army defending a spherical base or an army besieging a city. You encircle it. Take control of the edges. You control the center and the whole. Circle the wagons on the prairie. If you control the edges, you are in control of everything that happens inside it. Friends, this is the most amazing thing, the most amazing thing. God is saying to us, travel to the outer edges of the most infinite mysteries of the universe. Travel there, and I am there at the edges. At the edges. I control the wildest frontiers. I patrol the borders. And so I'm in charge of every domain. And so I think that leads us to say this. Here's why this all matters for us. Here's what I think is happening. God is showing Job that he does not have all the information to hand to ever accuse him of doing wrong. Isn't that right? God is showing Job he does not have all the information to hand to accuse him of doing wrong. And you see, the way God does that for Job is not by revealing all the information that God has about Job's suffering. That's not what God does. He doesn't tell Job everything he knows. Rather, he does it by increasing Job's awareness of how little he knows. Anybody who's ever studied a lot, spent their life studying, professors, academics, the most wise, the most humble tell you they've been on a long journey of realizing how little they know. It's what God does here to Job. Takes him on a journey, not to tell him everything, but to increase Job's awareness of how big God is and how much he knows. I think there is a very particular lesson in the way God has done this. If you are ignorant, Job, about all the sorts of things you can perceive with your eyes, okay, think about it, the sea, the sun, the light, the dark, the stars, the rain, the lightning, everyday things that touch us, you see them, but you don't really know them. Job, if you are ignorant about things like that which you can see, is it possible that you might be ignorant about what I know when it comes to the suffering you can see and feel? It's the same thing, isn't it? We feel suffering, just like we feel the light on our bodies, and God is saying the two things have a depth dimension to them you cannot know. See, God has taken Job here on a long journey towards the right kind of ignorance. That's what's happened here, a long journey towards the right kind of ignorance. And look how God is doing it here. He's doing it to Job with questions. With questions, not a lecture. Each and every time Job is meant to stand back, you see, and reflect and try to join up the dots. If I don't see all that there is to see with that, then maybe I don't know all there is to see with this. And maybe I might not know all there is to know about my pain. So I think this is a truly helpful perspective to begin to adopt, to learn to adopt for ourselves. I wonder here if God is showing Job that life with God is a bit like one of those great whodunit mysteries. I don't know whether you like reading them or watching them, where you see something taking place, and immediately as you see it, you think you know who did it. It's obvious. All the clues and signs are there. You think you know it all. And then slowly, as the story goes on, you begin to notice there are clues that you didn't spot, things you didn't see, evidence you weren't aware of. And along comes the brilliant detective or investigator or a judge, more clever than you, pieces all the evidence together, spots the things that you missed, and comes up with a totally different verdict. And it's the right one. It's what happens, isn't it, with the best of judges. It's what we want in judges. No verdict until all the evidence is in. All the evidence. Innocent until proven guilty. God is saying to Job, can you trust me that all the evidence is not in? All the evidence is not in. It is not in your hands, in your mind, in your world. All the evidence is not in front of you. I think here, Job has put God on trial, and God is collapsing the trial. He's not declaring Job guilty. He's not punishing him, not sending him away. Simply saying to him, you do not have all the evidence to hand to make the kind of accusations you're making. What kind of God am I that does this? Well, I love the imagery. Chapter 38, verse 29. Perhaps my favorite image here in the chapter. Does the rain have a father? Who fathers the drops of dew? From whose womb comes the ice? Who gives birth to the frost from the heavens? See, to you, Job, rain and dew and ice are just water. That's all they are. But to me, I fathered them and I mothered them and they come from my womb. Isn't God saying to Job, fathers know best, don't they? Children are often perplexed by the wisdom and the love of parents. It often causes them pain. But it is wisdom and it is love and it always knows best. Some experiences in life put our trust in God under attack. When that happens, here's what to realize. My experience is not all there is. I think I told you this before, 1945. Clement Attlee won a landslide victory in the general election. And just before his victory, Clement Attlee was on the receiving end of constant complaints and criticism from Harold Laski, who was the chair of the Labour Party. And you know this sort of person, you've met them. He was forever telling Clement Attlee how to do his job or insinuating that he should resign, making all sorts of comments about him, always constantly commenting. I know best, listen to me. And on one occasion, Attlee wrote back to Laski and he ended his letter with these words, "A period of silence from you would now be most welcome. A period of silence from you would now be most welcome." I think that is what God does to Job. In the face of all that he experienced, all that he lost, all that he went through, doesn't God put in front of Job the outer edges of the mystery of who he is? And what does Job say? I cover my mouth. I remain silent. Face to face with the God who cannot be known utterly and completely. So may God help us to be like Job, to listen, to watch, to learn, and to love him for his incomprehensibility. Amen.